Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday. It is very nice to have you with us. It is the 23rd of March, 12 minutes past 9 o'clock. Very nice to have you with us. Let me introduce our panel to you. It's a good one. We're happy, and we got a lot to talk about. I don't know what the hell happened after 5 o'clock last night, but apparently everything. Yeah. Everything. So we have a lot to talk about. I kept on thinking, why are all those dings on my phone? Oh, yeah, all right.
Every hour on the hour.
Right. That's right.
You're going to have to do the roundtable three times a day to stay current.
I know. I don't know how you do that even, no. But here we go. We're going to make our best attempt. Aaron Pasitti wasn't with us last week. He's with us this week, and we couldn't be more delighted, especially right after a budget gets passed. That's important. He is economics professor at Siena College.
Good morning.
And are you still chair?
I am still chair.
Okay. Congratulations.
It's a sentence.
Okay. Well, we hope you get a commute
and I'm serving
or whatever. Yes.
With pride and humility.
As you should. It's wonderful to have you here. Thank
Good
you
to be
very
back.
Much. Judith Enck is the former regional administrator for the EPA, Region 2, don't you know? And she joins us every Friday, and we couldn't be more delighted. Good morning. How
Good
are
morning.
You?
Good morning. Day 428 of the Trump administration. Not that I'm counting.
Thank you for bringing us up to date.
So how many days are left?
I think that's
too
many.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we need the countdown.
Down,
maybe
right.
not
that's
countdown.
That's right.
Right.
Right. Right.
I have to
right,
do the
right.
reverse.
Also, Joe Bonilla is here. He is a communications consultant and a good friend of ours, and we're thrilled to have him on the program. Thank you very much for being here.
Great to be here. Good morning.
Alan Chartok joins us as well. Good morning, Alan.
Yo.
Nice to have you here. Thank
nice
you very
to be
much.
Here.
All right. Well, we got a lot to talk to everybody about, so let's get started and start this process. And again, I said this yesterday, I'll say it again today. It's hard to know where to start. It really is hard to know where to start. But we'll go with this. H.R. McMaster out. John Bolton in. So
Earth screwed.
Right.
Sorry.
So just I don't know, a day or two after the fake New York Times wrote that article saying that H.R. McMaster would be leaving and John Bolton would be going in, and the president tweeted that that was false and that wasn't happening and they don't know anything and they don't know about his legal team, they don't know about his administration. Well, everything that the Times had reported actually came to fruition yesterday. John Dowd, the attorney, the head attorney on the Trump attorney looking into the representing him in the Mueller affair, he resigned, and then H.R. McMaster gets fired, and John Bolton gets hired. So pretty much as advertised. We're going to focus first on the McMaster story because there's basically two through lines here. One is that it involves John Bolton coming into that job, which I believe he begins in April, right?
Correct.
Second week in
yep.
April, is that correct? And then also just the sheer number of people who have been fired since the beginning. This is the third person who has held that position as National Security Advisor. So that says a lot. Alan, let's begin.
Yeah. Well, McMaster really was screwed because, as you know, he's a serving Army officer. He's a general. They couldn't find a place, apparently, to send him back to, so he was forced to resign. There will be those people who are listening right now and say, good, he should have never taken that job in the first place. He should have known what he was getting into. The point really is that he was holding the president down. In many ways, the president didn't want to get held down. He was part of the institution that was saying to him, no, you can't do this. It's going to hurt the United States. Yesterday, and I can't wait to hear Aaron on this, we saw this precipitous fall in the stock market because of our relationship with China. And there's military involved. Now you have Bolton coming along. Mm-hmm. And what's he said as a Fox commentator? He said we ought to do a strike on North Korea before they can get us. This is really frightening. And, it keeps getting worse. It keeps looking like the man who wagged the dog.
And obviously we'll get to the China story too, but that's right. It's all in here. The last job that John Bolton held was that of a Fox correspondent, as Alan mentioned, and as a result, there's a lot of tape coming out and a lot of things that he has said over the last several years, even in the last several months, that I think would cause many to have great concern. And by the furrowed brows I see around this table, I assume it starts here at home. Judith.
Well, it's very frightening. I think this is the singular worst appointment that President Trump has made, and that says a lot. But for those who care about peace in the world and security, you know, Bolton is a hawk.
Can I just interrupt you real quick just to ask this question, because I should have looked this up and I didn't. Why he was passed over initially during the transition.
Right.
He was passed over.
Right.
Do we know why?
Well, he wanted to be Secretary of State, and they knew they could not get him through the Senate. Remember when Bush had him at the United Nations, he was a recess appointment, even with the Republicans controlling the Senate. He is so far out there on the war continuum that Republicans knew they could not get him Senate confirmed. So when he was UN ambassador, it really was only for under 2 years.
A year and a half.
It wasn't that long. And then he stepped down because he could not get Senate confirmation. I looked, you know, at his background. He is described as fairly bright. He's a lawyer. He knows how to play the Washington game. You know, he's been a Fox commentator for the last 8 years. You know, he's kind of on the think tank circuit, and he hasn't been in government for some time, but he knows how to work the bureaucracy. And typically the person in this position is supposed to be the honest broker. He's not going to be that. He comes in with some very aggressive, defined views. And the notion that we're going to have John Bolton in the Situation Room making, you know, life and death decisions with a president who is so unstable is very frightening.
So, you know, Bolton is the hawk of hawks in foreign policy, and it seems to clash with Trump's desire to pursue diplomacy with North Korea. And now you have an NSA or the National Security Advisor saying the only solution to North Korea is a preemptive strike. He wants to not only tear up the Iran nuclear accord, but also overthrow the government of Iran. So this is not somebody within the mainstream, even within the conservative realm. So I have two thoughts here. And the first is that maybe this is a really clever play on Trump's part to pursue diplomacy, but also to have this leverage with somebody who's threatening or who's willing to do a preemptive strike on North Korea.
Quite a gamble.
It's a huge gamble, but it's a gamble that might pay off because, you know, it's not like we've been successful negotiating with North Korea in the past. So if this is the, you know, the sledgehammer that Trump has in his back pocket, then that could, and I stress the word could, make negotiations between Trump and Kim Jong-un more successful. The other issue, which I think is the bigger concern, is that my wife's former boss, Victor Cha, who's a Georgetown professor and was nominated to be the U.S. ambassador to South Korea under Trump, had a really interesting perspective on this. And that is, if you believe Kim Jong-un is undeterrable, which a lot of people do, a preemptive strike is not going to deter him from responding because the assumption is that he's undeterrable. So there's 300,000 U.S. citizens in South Korea and Japan at any given day. So if there's a preemptive strike and North Korea responds in kind because they assume Kim Jong-un is undeterrable, you're looking at, you know, conventional shelling of both countries and massive amounts of not only South Korean and Japanese citizen casualties, but also U.S. citizen casualties. And the second part of that is, if you believe Kim Jong-un is unpredictable, which I think is a fairly standard view, then a preemptive strike could lead to massive escalations in a way that nobody can foresee. So like Alan said, this is a huge gamble if it is part of Trump's negotiating strategy.
And you know, one other thing, guys, and that is that it seems to me that I'm reading somewhere that Bolton in addition to all of these other exposures, has now got a little bit of a hand in the whole Facebook mess.
Right. He has a PAC.
He doesn't. He did hire Cambridge Analytica.
He's raised like $15 million to support Republican candidates all over the country. It's called the John Bolton Super PAC.
Very creative name.
Humble.
Yeah. I'm sorry. He raised $11.3 million for Republican candidates, and he paid Cambridge Analytica $650,000 recently to do some voter data research for some Republican candidates. And I might add, the major donor to his PAC is Robert Mercer.
Exactly.
It's a small world.
Right. But the one thing I do want to touch upon is that
small world of billionaires. Yes,
right.
Oligarchs. You know,
but this is, again, another more dangerous installment of As the White House Turns. And we look at, again, more and more of what we deem to be the adults in the room, McMaster, Tillerson, and others, and possibly, you never know, with John Kelly. John Kelly might be on his way out as well. But this, again, the Bolton appointment should be seen more on the domestic end as really invigorating the base coming up for the midterm election. And that's my look at it. You know, I don't think the Trump administration has the sophistication to look at this more in the foreign policy lens. I think this is really, you know, giving that red meat to the base in that way.
The Fox News green room, as they say, is clearing out. This is the fifth major Fox News commentator currently serving in the administration. Don't forget the lawyer that President Trump hired for his defense team, Joe DeGeneva, who mostly is kind of a conspiracy theory dude on Fox News a lot. KT McFarlane, Larry Kudlow, Heather Nowak at the State Department, and now Bolton.
The list goes on and on.
So yeah, it's basically whoever is on Fox News that grabs the president's attention. Suddenly, they're in charge of the economy,
right,
and they're in charge of war and peace.
So, well, but the great news here is that when the Democrats get back into office, Rachel Maddow is going to be the Secretary of State.
And let's not forget about Peter Navarro, Trump's economic advisor, who was not part of the Fox News rotating talking head circuit, but when he wanted to make the case to Trump about the steel and aluminum tariffs, he didn't go to Trump directly. He went on Fox News knowing Trump would watch it,
exactly.
And then Trump pulled him into the more formal discussions of the policy. So I guess Fox News is the
State-run TV.
The farm team for the Trump administration.
And then they go back. Yeah. Sebastian Gorka left the administration. He's back on Fox.
That's a revolving door.
One big revolving door.
So with Bolton, then that does also bring us to the fact that the legal team has changed. John Dowd is out. And so my question there is, what does that tell us about the state of affairs? Because the analysis that I keep reading says, well, it shows that the president wants much more say in the defense and how this goes, which I don't think any of those lawyers think is a good idea.
He's now his own lawyer with Mueller. He doesn't want to listen to lawyers. He's bringing in Fox News personalities. I don't think this ends well for the president if he thinks he can bring in these high-profile, aggressive lawyers rather than real lawyers. You remember a few days ago, Ted Olson, who I'm not a huge fan of, but who is a real lawyer, declined representing the president, as has all of the major accomplished white shoe lawyers in New York and Washington. They don't want anything near this.
So do you think they don't want to be near it because they see it as an unwinnable case? Two, that they're just dealing with a client who is at this point completely off leash, or three, that it's a client who has a pretty solid history of not paying employees.
Probably all three.
Yes.
Yeah. I would say all three.
All of the above.
Yeah. Yes. All of the above.
And one other possibility, what would your mate, your husband or your wife tell you? Because they're always the smart ones in the family. If you were considering joining the Trump administration, they would say, stay out of it because you're going to get sucked into the vortex. You're going to get sucked into this, and you're going to come out in prison.
With the exception, that's a good point, Alan, but Joe DiGenova, who has entered the lion's den, his wife is also an attorney, and she apparently is joining the legal team as well. Alan, I remember during the beginning of the Trump administration, you and I had a conversation about who was taking these jobs in the White House, and we talked about how, you know, even if someone is not fully on board with the Trump agenda, it's a prestigious appointment. Now it's the opposite. No one wants their career stained by serving in the White House. And when they leave, they actually have a very hard time finding jobs.
Well, it's initial period after the first year, the first month, really. And now looking at the reality of what the administration's tactics and strategy is, why would you be part of it?
I mean, the other thing is that Dowd was not perfect. So he forwarded emails to journalists and government officials saying that the secessionist Civil War propaganda and equated that to the American Revolution against England, that in a lunchtime conversation with another lawyer, that he was openly discussing confidential information that was overheard by a New York Times reporter.
That was
and
a
subsequently
great story,
reported.
By the way. Yeah.
And
you should all look it up.
And Dowd also said something that Trump knew Flynn lied to the FBI before Trump admitted it. So
what you're saying is that he was the perfect lawyer for Donald Trump.
Exactly. Yeah, somebody who doesn't fully think things through.
That was a good match. Right. It's a shame they broke up.
And remember his Saturday morning tweet last week where he said he was praying for Mueller to end the investigation. He confirmed last night that he did that in concert with the president. He wasn't out on his own.
Although they were saying, the narrative later that day after the tweet was that he did it on his own and not...
I thought he nailed in that tweet is the White House is an area that definitely needs prayer.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned this because you know, I've been referencing this all along, and when it got real bad for Nixon, remember that whole thing? Henry Kissinger get down on the floor with him and pray. And I think when we get to the prayer stage, things are getting rough.
Well, with the support of the evangelicals, you got it, right? You're all set.
Right.
You got a lot of prayer behind you. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We'll move on to other stories. We'll have letters, and we'll find out what's going on elsewhere. Here's a little clue. There's a lot. there's a lot. We will get to China and the stock market and all of that as well. We have Alan Chartok here. We have Joe Bonilla, Judith Enk, and Aaron Pasidi. And, of course, we welcome your letters. We'd love to read them. For the most part, it's panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org.
Nothing is forever.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have a lot to talk about, and we'll get to that. We have letters as well. Panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Joe Bonilla, Judith Enk, and Aaron Pasidi, all with us this morning on this Friday morning. Mike writes to us and says, let's see. Rex Tillerson was fired via Twitter. H.R. McMaster was fired by a telephone call. Donald Trump couldn't walk down the hall or summon McMaster to his office for the firing. Such courage. And then Mike says an eye roll. The only people Trump has fired face-to-face is on The Apprentice, and that all that money and no class. If you want a job in Trump's White House, audition on Fox News.
Yeah, we were just saying that on the break. I mean, what the letter writer also reminds me of is, remember we heard months ago that there was a suicide pact between Mattis, Tillerson, and McMaster? If one went,
right,
they would all go. So last man standing is Mattis, and I know he's meeting with the president today on a topic, and I wonder if Mattis is going to stick around. My guess is Kelly will be out at some point, and then and then Mattis has to decide whether he wants to stay.
This is going to seem knee-jerk and probably, you know, a little snippy when I say it, but don't you assume at some point they're all going to be out?
Yes.
Two to three months, probably.
It doesn't seem like anybody has a really good... I don't think there's much longevity here.
It's more of a rapid clip, though, at this point. That's the only difference.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
But I do think losing Mattis will be consequential.
Yeah.
I mean, he is a military guy who believes in diplomacy. which we really can't say that about Pompeo or Bolton or the president or anyone else left in the White House.
So we're losing the generals, Alan.
My generals.
You know, it's ironic. I was sitting here thinking, as Judith said in her usual inimical and brilliant way about that. You know, the fact is that the generals are the ones who have been protecting the integrity of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And that's far from the 7 days in May model, although it was part of the movie. Yeah, I mean, I think we're losing the generals, and that ain't good because these people know the difference between sanity and insanity.
Speaking of firing people on Twitter and in non-face-to-face ways, I thought it was absolutely hysterical and completely appropriate that after Rex Tillerson was fired, that he said, "I hope Trump finds out about his impeachment on Twitter."
Oh, Tillerson said that?
Yep.
Good.
Wow.
Tillerson's got to tell the truth.
I missed that. Well, I missed that headline. Okay.
We believe you.
Yeah, I mean, we do believe you. Although I know he said it was a mean. I know in his speech he said that it was a mean town.
So that's from the New Yorker.
Yeah.
Oh, but it's Andy Borowitz, though.
Oh.
I think it's Andy Borowitz.
But I think Rex Tillerson.
I fell for that yesterday. Though.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
That's
no.
All right.
Tillerson does probably have a good book in him, which I think he should publish.
Well, can you imagine? Can you imagine? All right. Well, Dixie writes to us and says, it is their solemn duty to protect our country by pushing through legislation to protect Mueller and his team and their investigation.
Yeah, well, from your mouth to God's ear, you know, that's fine. You can write that letter and you can say it's their solemn duty, and it is their solemn duty, but it doesn't help the situation. It's good you wrote it, but I mean, what does that do?
And I missed the important thing that I missed here was the subject line of the letter, which was Ryan and McConnell. So meaning it's their solemn duty to protect our country by pushing through legislation to protect Mueller and his team and their investigation. Okay.
And you know what Ryan said 2 days ago?
Do jellyfishes have backbones?
Ryan said, "Oh, he'll never fire Mueller. This is not a problem. We don't need to pass a bill to protect Mueller."
Not something we have to worry about.
Ryan.
All right. Aishu writes to us about John Bolton and says, I'm afraid that Trump's latest appointment will help him rush to war perhaps before the midterms because he knows that he will be impeached if Dems take the Congress. Can Congress or anyone stop him? Well, I don't think we have any sign of that, do we?
No.
No.
Kathy says, so picture this. Just imagine Bolton and Trump decide to go to do the Bolton thing and launch a preemptive strike. North Korea responds. What do they think China will do? What will Russia do while China and the U.S. and North Korea are at it? What will the EU do while Russia invades Eastern Europe? Holy cow.
I can chime in on the China thing. So China's foreign policy is non-intervention and secure borders. And any type of strike on North Korea is going to lead to a huge influx of refugees from North Korea into China, and China doesn't want to get involved, and they want to secure their borders. So that could create incredible tension and hostility in U.S.-China relations. And given the tariff Trump is thinking about imposing, this could really sour relations with China.
Beyond
where they already are.
And this is a time when we really need Chinese cooperation on the Korean Peninsula. So his tariff decision, his Bolton decision could not come at a worse time. I was really struck by a quote from a guy from Seoul, South Korea, with the Institute for Peace and Cooperation. Because I think the South Koreans probably have more on the line here than anyone appointment.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said that South Korea has, quote, bad chemistry with Bolton. And that Bolton, I think this says this beautifully, Bolton is all about sticks.
Yeah.
And stones.
Yep.
But not carrots.
And breaking bones, right.
Yeah.
So the we've talked about Bolton. I have a couple more letters I want to get to. But we talked about Bolton and North Korea. We've talked about Bolton and China. But there is some discord, not discord perhaps, but a dissonance in what the president says about Russia and what Bolton says about Russia, right? Mm-hmm. So I wonder what we're going to make of that, because the Bolton, it has no problems calling Russia out, where the president does seem to have a great deal of trouble doing that.
I think Bolton's going to hold his fire on Russia. I think he disagrees with the president, but I don't think it's a huge priority for him. He's going to save his political capital for North Korea and the Middle East. Yeah. And I think he's just going to, you know, swallow some of his opinions on Russia. That's not his fight right now. He has bigger fights he literally wants to launch.
Unless he really believes he can change the president's mind, which everybody believes they can until they find out otherwise.
Well, that'll be the interesting dynamic here. I mean, the only thing that I'm a little hopeful about, hopeful being too strong a word here, is they're both alpha dogs. And neither of them back down. And I think, you know, Bolton will turn away only so many times. My guess is within 6 weeks, they'll be at each other's throats.
Six?
Four.
Okay.
Do you want to do a shot bet on that?
Were you going to say something now? And I'm sorry.
No, I think it keeps coming back to the personal here. That no matter who disagrees with him on Russia, he can't get off the dime. And that's why I think Brennan was right. They've got something on him. I think there's a very good possibility that no matter what nonsense goes on about Russia and how much we know, this man cannot afford to be, in his own mind, to be seen giving a tough time to the Russians. He cannot. So that's where this thing keeps adding up and adding up, and I think it adds up to potential impeachment.
Keith writes and says, this is an awful morning. John Bolton is what we get when the GOP gives into Trump's bad behavior and abandons their responsibilities. When will Ryan McConnell and the GOP stand up to Trump and do the right thing? The answer is probably somewhere between November 8th, 2018 and never.
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 Yeah, never. Never. I mean, if they haven't stood up to him by now,
there's not a chance.
Forget McConnell and Ryan. Gone.
Dan says, I hope everyone is paying attention to the fact it's obvious what is coming down the tracks, and yet the Trump administration keeps denying it. For example, the New York Times reporting that McMaster is on the way out and Bolton on the way in, and Trump and company denying it. Then, boom, it happens. So now we see the Trump administration denying that Mueller will be fired, and complicit in this dishonest behavior is the Republican Congress that refuses to protect Mueller. Well, it's hard to argue with that theory, right? Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll move on to other subjects. And we still welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
There's something in the water, Byzantine, and everyone's down.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Donald Trump moving to crack down on China trade with $60 billion in tariffs on imported products. That was the headline. And then, of course, the stock market did respond. President Trump took the first steps toward imposing tariffs on $60 billion in Chinese goods and limiting China's ability to invest in the U.S. technology industry Thursday, saying the moves were a response to Beijing's history of forcing U.S. companies to surrender their trade secrets to do business in China. The president directed U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, is that great? Correct? Want to say? Yeah. To announce within 15 days a proposed list of products to be hit with tariff increases after a public comment period. The final list, designed to target Chinese products that benefited from improper access to U.S. technology, will be made public. Then, of course, the response by the stock market as stocks tumbled yesterday. A brewing trade war between China and the United States sends markets reeling across Asia on Friday following a sell-off on Wall Street overnight. And I believe as of right now, the Dow is actually up, but only slightly. So
I can't wait to hear from Aaron on this. I'll tell you why. Because it is clear they were in panic yesterday as the market was taking this what, 3% fall? Huge. Yeah. And then they decided, whether at the time or anticipating this, that they should change their view on the tariffs on aluminum and steel. Mm-hmm. And they, so they let the allies off, saying, uh-oh, we better do something. Yes, Aaron?
Well, there's a lot to unpack here. So, what, you know, an important thing to remember is that the stock market is one very imperfect indicator of economic performance, and it can respond to a lot of different information. So, you know, the you know, richest 10% of the population owns about 90% of all stocks. So don't put too much emphasis on movements in the stock market. But it does reflect the psychology of how, you know, money managers and financiers are looking at Trump's policies. So with that note, China accounts for 13% of all U.S. imports. It's about $500 billion out of about 3.7 trillion.
It's still huge.
It's still huge. So with Trump's 30% tariffs, that's that equates to about a like a 12.5% tax or 12.5% increase in the price of Chinese imports. The biggest issue here is the uncertainty issue, much like it was with the steel and aluminum tariffs. He hasn't specified what goods will be subject to tariffs. Is this going to be just an all-encompassing 30% tariff? And that uncertainty can lead to a lot of negative economic effects. So back in 2009 and 2010, when President Obama was, you know, inherited the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression and was pushing forward Obamacare, the Wall Street Journal was saying, all of this policy uncertainty is going to kill the economy. It's going to cripple business investment. It's going to cripple hiring. And, you know, they weren't wrong in terms of economic uncertainty having negative economic effects, but it didn't happen under Obama. And I'm going to name names because these people deserve to be called out. Economists like Martin Feldstein, Casey Mulligan, and John Cochran, who frequently write on the op-ed pages for the New York Times, were just pounding the hammer of uncertainty is going to cripple the economy. And now you actually see real uncertainty with Trump specifying these very vague tariffs, and all of them are just absolutely silent now.
And another critic was Larry Kudlow.
And Larry Kudlow, right.
Right, right.
So obviously this is going to result in slightly higher prices for U.S. consumers. But it's not going to have any major effect on improving wages or employment for the working class, because obviously China's not going to take this and say, oh, okay. They're going to retaliate with their own, you know, trade restrictions, whether it's, you know, tariffs on U.S. firms exporting to China or going back to devaluing the yuan to make imports cheaper and essentially counteracting the tariff by foreign currency interventions. So again, this is just if Trump is trying to put America first and boost wages and hiring for, you know, struggling sectors and middle class Americans, this is the exact opposite way to accomplish that. There needs to be job training for sectors that are growing. You know, steel employment has been down tremendously over the past three decades, as has manufacturing employment more generally. Part of that's due to globalization, but a big part of that is due to automation of just, you know, incredible productivity growth in these industries. So if you're trying to save, you know, middle-class manufacturing jobs, it's not imposing selective tariffs on selective countries, on selective products. It's proposing things like guaranteed employment, you know, resources for job training.
Infrastructure spending.
You know, we libertarians are even starting to talk about basic incomes that are just because these jobs are not coming back with or without tariffs.
But here's the thing is it's an easy rallying cry to paint China as the enemy on the domestic front, especially as the president looks everything at this very narrow political lens. For him, this is easy. Oh, let's impose some tariffs on China. This will rally. Basically, when I go out and rallies, whether it's in West Virginia, Wisconsin, all these Rust Belt states, that's really the point of this. There's no other logic behind it.
No, you're absolutely right. It is a political move that has ignored all of the major economic trends that have been hurting the manufacturing sector and middle class workers for the past four decades. And he's not getting to the root of the problem because he doesn't care about the root of the problem. He cares about getting votes in the midterms right. for Republicans. And, you know, he's already got his reelection team put together. This is very self-serving. It's very clear and easy to understand for most people, but it's not going to fix the problem at all.
Right. And it may not really help politically because there was some speculation that the steel tariffs were to prop up the guy running against Democrat Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania. Right. And that guy finally conceded yesterday. I thought the interesting thing about yesterday in the Dow was that Congress averted a government shutdown and announced right. quite a large spending, yay, federal budget, except too much spending on military. But, you know, HUD has record spending. Trump had proposed a 31% budget cut at EPA, and Congress said no to mm-hmm. that and did EPA's budget the same as it was the year before. But this is a pretty big deal in terms of the federal budget, and that was all but right. ignored, and the Dow plummeted because of the Trump announcements.
And the Federal Reserve decided to raise interest rates again from 1.5 to 1.75%, right. which has a detrimental effect on stocks. So it's tough to separate out where the decline in the stock market stems from, whether it's the uncertainty over the budget agreement, whether it's the Federal Reserve raising rates or the China tariffs, or D, all of the above. And it's probably
Wait. I'm still confused, as you know. I don't understand something here. The Chinese are ripping us off, right? Everybody agrees. Intellectual property, no matter whose administration, we've all known this is going on. But for some reason, the status seemed to have been all right. In other words, the moment we said, we're going to hold you accountable and we're going to put tariffs on and we're going to do this to you, the market goes gaflooey. So somehow there seems to be a secret understanding between the people who run the economy in this country, the people who run the economy in that, you can go just so far and we'll put up with it. And when we try to change that equation, the market is going to go mm-hmm. down. Am I wrong about that?
No,
that sounds, that's fairly accurate. You know, yes, China has very lax copyright and intellectual property laws. They reverse engineer a lot of products. But let's not forget that if you're talking about free trade, patents are the epitome of the least form of free trade, in that it's a government guaranteed monopoly. And that's a huge burden to American consumers because it raises the prices of goods that have patents and copyright protections, whether it's music or pharmaceuticals or what have you. So, you know, that's it. You know, I don't think China's been ripping us off. They've been figuring out ways to produce what we produce more effectively without government regulation, and U.S. consumers are getting cheaper products.
So are they playing fair?
No. I mean,
well, it depends what you define as fair.
Look at what they pay their workers. I mean,
that's because they have a labor force of, you know, almost a billion. So we.
I remember seeing a special on 60 Minutes a few years ago that really stuck with me. They looked at the Apple manufacturing facility in China and a few other big American companies in China, where workers live in barracks and work 7 days a week. And it's so bad that they put giant nets outside of the residences because people were committing suicide, literally jumping out the window at such a rapid pace because they were separated from their families, working huge mm-hmm. hours. Those are not the labor standards we want to be supporting, but that is a lot of the Chinese economy.
Right, but that's a separate equation from intellectual property laws. I'm not saying China has the best labor regulations,
right.
but now that wages have been rising in China, and this is one of the greatest anti-poverty programs in world history in a very short time frame. That is, wages rise in China. All that's going to do is push production to Vietnam and Cambodia and Honduras.
We'll just go somewhere else.
The same problems there.
Right.
So it's not just China. This is going to happen wherever. But China's been the boogeyman for the past 15 or 20 years. So, yeah, let's go after them because it's visible.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will we'll talk about the budget. We'll talk about the fact that, as of moments ago, the president has said that he is going to perhaps veto the spending bill because it neglected his immigration priorities.
No.
So we'll talk about that.
No. Okay.
And we'll let the panel do their homework here in the meantime. But we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. Alan Shartok is here, Joe Bonilla, Judith Enck, and Aaron Pasitti. As I mentioned, just going into the break, Donald Trump says he may veto the spending bill, risking a government shutdown. He threatened on Friday to veto the 1.3. We didn't even get to talk about this fully yet, and already it's threatened to be vetoed. Just hours before the government was set to shut down for lack of funds, lashing out over its failure to fund his long-promised border wall. I am considering a veto, all capital letters, of the omnibus spending bill based on the fact that the 800,000-plus DACA recipients have been totally abandoned by the Democrats, not even mentioned in bill, and the border wall, all caps, which is desperately needed for our national defense, is not fully funded.
So disingenuous. President Trump created the DACA crisis, and a judge's decision has saved him from imminent problems. And we know he doesn't really care about the DACA kids. And then on the border wall, remember, Mexico was supposed to pay for it. And I think he's embarrassed because he wanted $25 billion and the Congress agreed to something like $1.6 billion. So it's clearly a huge loss in this budget debate. And for him, it's not what's best for the country. It's what's best for his ego. I predict this is a just a wild threat that he is not going to follow through on.
You know what? It's all about the base. It's all about the base. We can never forget that, right?
Yeah,
so you
right.
Take a look at this bill. What's in it? You know, Chuck Schumer looks like the Cheshire Cat sitting there with a smile on his face. He's not saying a word. But what's in the bill? Planned Parenthood?
Mm-hmm.
Planned Parenthood is back in the bill. That's great from my perspective. But, you know, the base ain't going to like it. What else is in there? Well, Corporation for Public Broadcasting, you know, is in there.
Funding for the National Science Foundation.
The Democrats won this budget, and they're in the minority party. Trump signed off on this budget agreement. So, Alan, you're right. It's all about the base. He's going to make some noise, but it's kind of pointless because I don't see the House and the Senate reopening this, and so he's going to look impotent that he made this threat. I predict he's not going to follow through on it.
Remember, Trump is a businessman, and a lot of people have said for many years that we need a business person to run the U.S. government. Well, remember, business people have legal obligations to their shareholders, not the public at large. And when you have a president who is a businessman, his obligation and priorities are to his shareholders. And in this case, it's his base. It's the voters. It's not the public interest. And this is a very clear example of him ignoring the public interest for very narrow, self-serving reasons.
But it's not surprising whatsoever that he's doing this.
No, absolutely not. I want to go back to the uncertainty issue that, you know, we have a Republican Congress and a Republican president, and they still can't agree on a long-term budget. That was less surprising when Obama was in office and you had a massive deficit because of the stimulus and the recession. And Republicans were constantly threatening to not pass these temporary spending bills, shut down the government. That's not surprising. But now that you have a Republican president and a Republican Congress, that they still are waiting to the last minute to do these things. And this only funds the government through September. So we're halfway through the fiscal year, and this is only another six-month plan, creates an enormous amount of uncertainty for businesses who are looking to make long-term investments because, without getting technical, that the more uncertainty there is, the higher interest rates go, which means it's more expensive for businesses and consumers to borrow. And that's going to crimp job growth, and this could come back to really hurt the economy if this just continues. You're going to see a lack of long-term investment.
It's not just uncertainty. You're being very nice, Aaron. It's chaos.
Okay.
It's the chaos presidency.
That's the academic coming out.
Chaos. If you're trying to gauge whether or not to make investments based on federal policies, it's very hard to do with this gentleman in the White House.
Yeah, long term, you just can't do it.
And I use the term gentleman loosely.
Yes,
so somebody will write in, don't worry. What do you think the next couple of hours is going to be like between in the Ryan offices, the McConnell offices, and the White House?
Well, Schumer and many congressional leaders are at Louise Slaughter's funeral today, the longest serving woman in the Congress, I believe. Right, Joe?
Correct.
So yet again, a very insensitive move for the president to put this tweet out while most congressional leaders are in Rochester.
But you know he doesn't care.
He doesn't care. They will scramble back to D.C. I think this is an idle threat, but I think Ryan and McConnell are probably freaking out. And it was really interesting that Chuck and Nancy did not claim credit for this budget because they learned from the DACA experience. Right. So they were appropriately quiet. But I think the Senate and House Republicans are probably sweating it.
Oh, today. Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So let's see. I've got some letters here. Let's do those real quick. Ann says, shortly after 9 o'clock this morning, all right, well, that was what we just talked about. Okay, legislation to protect Mueller. Congressional legislation to protect Robert Mueller would fail. President Trump would likely fire Mueller preemptively as soon as Congress begins debate on such legislation. Even were the legislation to somehow pass Congress, it would most certainly face a presidential veto. Congressmen who wish to see Mueller complete his investigation without interference by the Trump administration need to tread lightly so as not to antagonize the unpredictable president and hasten the firing. That from Richard. We got this from Genos, who says, regarding tariffs, I think regarding the tariffs, globalists fail to understand that keeping the money in the U.S. is what is important and not sending it overseas where it doesn't come back, only enriching the companies and their workers. Even if we have fewer manufacturing plants here, at least those companies that are based here are hiring American workers who get paid here and benefit their own companies and communities, rather. How do we fail to understand this? Because they have work, they can spend slightly more for goods as opposed to being unemployed, an undignified individual.
An important thing to remember here is that while China definitely devalued the yuan to make their products more cheaper to U.S. consumers, the U.S. ran a strong dollar policy, which made imports cheaper for U.S. consumers at the same time. So, you know, when you accuse China of currency manipulation, the U.S. has been manipulating its currency in the opposite direction since the early 1990s, which had the effect of making imports from any country cheaper, specifically China, and exports from U.S. firms to any other country more expensive. So you can't just accuse China of being a currency manipulator.
It's a two-way street.
It's a two-way street, and that has hurt a lot of U.S. exporters in manufacturing and goods-producing industries.
Well, putting the intellectual property theft issues aside, from an environmental perspective, I want to say that it's not necessarily a bad thing to import lots of plastic crap from China. From a climate change perspective, you've got to look at how far we're shipping all of this stuff. And we often promote buying locally for a range of environmental and labor and economic justice issues. So I don't fall in any of the particular camps. In fact, on the show a few weeks ago, I was not that upset about the steel tariffs. Now, I recognize we are a global economy. You can't put that genie back in the bottle. But if this is an opportunity to reduce consumption, overconsumption, and shipping things long distances, I think environmentally there are some benefits here.
Well, I would look at it, at least on a personal level, you know, in the work that we do with craft beverages, you look at steel kegs, you look at other things like that, where it's, you know, it's obviously cheaper. They want to use locally made products in that way.
If you can find it.
And this only makes America a little less competitive in that way.
Alan, anything? No?
You're good? No, I'm sitting here listening to my betters.
But just remember, to the Judas point, and I'm not I'm politely disagreeing with you, yeah, is that whether it's coming from China doesn't matter. It'll come from Vietnam next, and then it'll come from Cambodia, and then it'll come from Sri Lanka. So it's coming from whichever country has the weakest labor standards and the lowest wages. So if you want to promote more domestic U.S. consumption, you can do that by investing in things like green energy and getting and training workers who have lost steel producing jobs to work in those industries.
Yeah. Or people who've lost coal jobs,
far
more jobs in wind and solar and geothermal than coal. Coal is pretty much dead in this country.
And the tariffs that have been imposed, the assumption is that that's going to save jobs and boost workers' wages. That's not true. Because the primary effect of tariffs is that it'll raise prices that U.S. Producers get, which means it'll increase profits for those companies and those industries. And there's no law that says those companies need to hire more workers or raise their workers' wages. They can invest in new technologies that further accelerate the job loss due to automation. It'll increase profits of companies that have been protected by these tariffs and will probably have minimal effect on job creation and saving jobs and wage growth.
Professor Pacetti is correct.
Absolutely.
I just wanted to say my...
Remember, I said the reason people don't like economists is because they're always right.
I wouldn't go that far.
Me neither. But let me go back to the coal reference. It's a little divergent from what we were talking about. But do you think the fact that Trump has done nothing to save the coal industry, which he promised, and bring it back. And as you said, coal is dead. You're quite right about that. But you think that any of those people are going to vote for the Democrat the next time?
Well, I think in the Connor Lamb race in Pennsylvania, it was interesting. And, that part of Pennsylvania is practically West Virginia. And there were a lot of coal miners who did not go for the Republican because they're smart.
They know the truth, finally.
They know that Trump does the photo ops, and sadly, he's repealing the Clean Power Plan and all the important EPA Clean Air Act regulations, but it's not saving the coal industry. So I think the coal miners are smarter than what Trump gives them credit for.
The coal miners gave Trump a chance. They saw after the last year and few months of his administration that he is not really on their side. He's not for the forgotten man.
Well, as I said, you are my betters, and I defer to you. However, I do think you're probably wrong on this one. I think that what this was all about was that the coal miners and many other quote, forgotten Americans just thought that they were getting screwed, and they wanted to send a message, we're getting screwed. And it really had less to do with the actual coal than it did with the idea that we're forgotten.
But they still are.
Right.
Yes.
So
they are.
So if you've been forgotten by 40 years of very pro-business, pro-elite economic policy, you realize Democrats and Republicans aren't on your side. So you look to these outside candidates because what's the harm? And, it's really a shame that the Democrats did not see this coming and ignored the white working class and didn't put Bernie Sanders forward.
Well, you know what I missed? I asked a political professional, which is not myself. I asked someone right after the election, how did we all miss this? And my friend said, Judith, have you ever watched The Apprentice? And I said, no, I never have. And he said, many, many people have, and they were really attracted to the guy on The Apprentice, and they just wanted to disrupt it. And you gotta get with the program here. Get off of, NPR and PBS, and look at what most Americans are watching. Sorry, NPR and PBS.
Well, if not most, at least a third.
Sure,
right. That's right, a third. All right, one other thing I want to mention before we go. Hundreds marching for March for Our Lives. There are hundreds of March for Our Lives demonstrations planned for Saturday. High school students say this is a moment of political awakening for their generation. They're happening in Washington and all over. Actually, some 800 protests planned. The New York Times, although there are many places that do this, have a great map of where they are and what's being done.
Yeah, I think this is so important. I will be at the Albany March for Our Lives tomorrow morning. It's at the Capitol. It starts at 10 a.m. There are also marches in Poughkeepsie. Poughkeepsie, at Walkway Over the Hudson. There's a march in Bennington. So you just have to go to the March for Our Lives website. Alan, I think there's one in Pittsfield.
And big one in New York City, which is where we're going to be tomorrow. And I'll be covering it as a journalist, of course, but Roselle will be there with a big sign.
Well, and I think, you know, it's interesting, since the first women's march after the Trump election, there's been this new model. You don't always have to go to Washington for these things or these organic events that pop up all over the country.
Yeah.
Occupy Wall Street was...
You know, but what's so interesting here, which is fascinating, is that these guys, the women came out. I was at that one. Roselle was at that one, the huge sign and the rest of it. They went away, and then that was the end of that. But these kids are future voters. They're taking over. And I have to say, there are results coming out of this that we never expected to see.
Right, including in the budget, it was, you know, if in fact the budget survives, there are some very modest improvements on hardening schools, on background checks. You also see Citibank saying if they're going to lend, they'll only lend to businesses that have policies of only selling guns to people who are 21 or older, no assault weapons, longer background checks. So I think these high school kids are really having an impact, and I think tomorrow it's important to lift their voices for them to be visible and be in the lead.
And they're so well organized and they're so active. I was talking to a client's daughter down in Chatham, and she's part of this march. She's trying to get all of her, you know, fellow colleagues in school to do it. And in terms of like them reaching out to media, them reaching out to others, elected officials, I mean, it's so gratifying to see them do this. And I want them to keep up the energy, keep up the momentum, and go from there.
There was an unusually good NPR story this morning. That was a shot. About the kids. And they had one young man on saying, we're getting advice from the Vietnam people and all the protests, and said, let us take over for you. Let us take over for you and we'll show you how to do it. Right. Forget it, Jack. Let the kids do their thing.
It's their time.
Yeah. And what else are you doing this weekend?
So tomorrow I'll be at the march and looking for lots of friends. On Sunday, I'm doing an experiment. I'm going to try to stay off Twitter on Sunday. My Twitter handle is ENCKJ. Please follow me. But I'm getting very stressed out about the Trump administration, especially John Bolton's appointment. And I can hear my husband laughing hysterically miles away. But I'm going to stay off Twitter on Sunday and see if I can have a more reflective, peaceful day and not be so caught up in all of this.
There was a New York Times article not that long ago about a gentleman who actually has been off of social media since the beginning of the Trump
administration. Well, that's just wrong. He's completely divorced from political reality.
But he said that his life is a lot better. He's able to have actual meaningful conversation. And, you know, it took a lot of people around him a long time to get used to. You can't discuss these different issues with him. But
the problem with that, though, is we have to be informed and involved.
True.
We just can't lose our minds. So I'm going to see if I can do it. And I wanted to announce this because it'll make it more likely that I will honor this. I want to take Sunday off from Twitter.
You know,
want to do something, Judith. You should run for Congress.
There are great candidates running, an embarrassment of riches.
You know, I was in a doctor's office about, three or four days ago. And as the old joke, of course, proved true in this, that the magazines were 12 years old that I was reading in the doctor's
highlights.
Office. Right, exactly. But there was this article about Mitt Romney going back as to why he lost the election and saying that he felt that he needed to tweet more. And I thought to myself, well, we've overcompensated for that.
Just a little bit.
To Judith's point, I really like listening to Ornette Coleman and a lot of free jazz. But since Trump's been elected, I can't do that.
Yeah.
So more Miles Davis and Mose Allison. Mm.
All right. We are out of time. My thanks to everybody. Have a great weekend. Very good doing whatever you do and all the good work. Thank you very much for being with us. Alan, thank you. Have fun in New York. Joe Bonilla, Judah, thank. Aaron Pasitti, thank you. We'll be back after this.
See you at the march.